I'm Pete McCarthy. You're listening to the Baseball and Barbecue Podcast.
From the studios of Baseball and BBQ on Long Island, New York, this is episode number 224. I'm Jeff the Hoku Cohen, along with Leonard Hollywood Aberman.
Speaking of, you know, you asked how I am. I tell you, I'm great. But, you know, you say from the studios on Long Island, New York, I think listening to us, people probably know where we're from.
Probably.
But Jeff, this is such an exciting episode. I wanted to say it's a rare triple play, but lately we've been doing a lot of triple plays, so yeah. It's kind of commonplace.
Exactly. Who do we got?
Well, we've got Todd Zeal. Jeff, who is Todd Zeal?
He played a Major League Baseball player who played for 11 teams and currently is the studio analyst for SNY and recently an inductee to the New York State Baseball Hall of Fame.
That's quite a resume. Yes. And Jeff, guest number two, we've got Monica Badlani of Curveball Whiskey. Whiskey that tastes like barbecue.
Absolutely.
And Jeff, not to give anything away, but you were enjoying a little bit of that beverage as we spoke to her, and it's quite good, right?
Very, very good. Yes.
Yes. And then Jeff, guest number three is Brian Ascala. He has written the book, Eddie the Legend. It is a work of fiction.
Yes, it
is. But it involves, the Mets are prominently on display or mentioned throughout the book.
The backdrop, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So we have three great guests, and we're going to get to the first one soon, but I want to tell everybody, it's Super Bowl time. And the usual suspects are heading to Vegas for the championship. And our partner, Bet Online, is your number one source for football odds, stats, trends, and lines. With everything from point spreads to hundreds of bets on everything from the coin toss to the color of Gatorade, Bet Online is the number one source for your championship wagering. Head to Bet Online and join today to get in to all the action. Bet Online. It is where the game starts.
And how are we going to start, Leonard?
Let's start with former Major League Baseball player Todd Zeal, current SNY broadcaster. Let's get right to Todd Zeal.
We have with us a New York State Baseball Hall of Famer. Drafted twice, once in the 30th round by the Royals, but he decided to stay at UCLA. Then a second round by the St. Louis Cardinals, where he signed and debuted on August 18, 1989. Spent 16 seasons in the major leagues with 11 teams, a majority of them with the Cardinals. And he played seven positions, including pitcher. He was part of the 2000 New York Mets World Series team under Bobby Vitti. According to Wikipedia, he's also the direct descendant of Presidents John Quincy Adams and John Adams. And today, he's part of the SNY broadcast team. Welcome to Baseball and BBQ, Todd Zeal. Welcome, Todd.
What's up, guys? That's quite the intro. And just we'll start with the first thing that you said, got drafted by the Kansas City Royals. Funny story about that. I was not expected to be drafted, obviously, 30th round pick. And the Royals saw me at a high school, you know, California all-star kind of tryout. And I was literally on the front street playing in front of my house, playing wiffle ball with my brother. My dad came out on draft day. I didn't even know it was draft day. It's very different back then. And said, hey, the Royals are on the phone. They said they drafted you. And I said, well, you told them I'm going to UCLA, right? And I'm going to school. So thanks. And I never even went in and talked to him. I continued playing my wiffle ball game on the street. So yeah, I don't, I feel like that was just a token to say, you know, good job with the tryout. But, you know, UCLA was good, and the rest, as you chronicled there, is history.
It is.
maybe you had a scout like watching you play wiffle ball, like, wow, if he can hit that.
Could have been. Could have been from my, I was quite good wiffle ball. I was a switch hitter in the wiffle ball games as well. So liked hitting left-handed.
So Todd, we met you at the New York State Baseball Hall of Fame induction. In fact, we met you last year and took it in 2022 and now in 2023, and you were inducted this year. On your 16 years in the Major League Baseball, 3.5 spent in New York, 3 with the Mets and a half season with the Yankees, your impact was huge, huge enough to be inducted into the New York State Baseball Hall of Fame. Tell me, that must have been a tremendous honor.
It was a tremendous honor. And I think, you know, it's interesting because the impact in New York was maybe bigger for me than it really was for the organizations of the city, but it does, you know, kind of represent the one city and one team, really the Mets, that I was able to kind of establish a legacy even after my playing days. And as you guys are well aware, my 16-year career was among 11 different teams. And although, you know, my numbers compiled over 16 years, you know, have a lot of great, you know, points to them, 250 plus home runs and 1100 plus RBIs and 2000 hits and things that, you know, if I had been with one organization, take it the Mets, for example, for those 16 years, those would be numbers that would be among the elite. And, but having such a fractured career, I never really felt like I was able to build a legacy with one particular team. So the Mets is special because I had three very significant milestones with that organization and, you know, played in a World Series there in 2000, ended my career there in 2004, and kind of most poignantly lived through and worked with the Mets in the recovery of 9/11 and was a part of that 9/21 game. So for those reasons, it gave me an opportunity to get into the booth and get into the studio, and have since, you know, really been able to kind of, I think, continue that sort of fractured legacy and make it a little bit more complete with New York and the Mets organization.
You know, Todd, you had a multifaceted career, player, your post-playing career as an analyst, your film work, even the fact that you're a direct descendant of, you know, the Adams presidents. So there's so much that we could talk about. One of the things sitting at your table at that dinner was great. You have great table manners, Todd. I just wanted to compliment you on that.
So. Well, you know, I've learned over the years, just sit, be quiet, speak when you're spoken to.
But the one thing that, you know, other than watching you as a player and seeing you as an analyst on SNY, I really was impressed by the speech that you gave. You gave a heartfelt speech, which you said was off the cuff. And you talked about being a player and then stepping away from the game for a while after. And that's something that you can, I mean, you could find your speech, you know, online, I think at the, you know, New York State Baseball Hall of Fame site. But most people, if they're looking at Wikipedia or whatever, they're not seeing that. That's something that I would like you to, if you could talk about that, because that was really impressive and meaningful.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the kind words. And it was, you know, coming in to that night and being kind of bestowed that honor, I, you know, thought much in the description that I just gave of my history with the multiple organizations and not really being able to feel, you know, kind of family like ties with any one organization. You know, I have had an opportunity to kind of establish that legacy with the Mets. And part of the reason for that is that I did, you know, step away from the game. And that's what you're referring to. And I had this idea of what I wanted to say when I went up there. I don't ever really like to prepare too much. I like to, you know, sort of have the thoughts come to me. And so somewhere during that time that I got into that room and I went up on stage, I leaned over to my wife right before it was my turn. I said, you know what? I kind of changed the thoughts on what I want to say tonight and try not to cry. And I'm like, because I know that's going to make it tougher on me. But, you know, when I ended my career, it wasn't really a great time in my life. I was dealing with a lot of things from, you know, a personal level, personal struggles, family struggles. I really had a lot of opportunities to maintain my presence in the game. I had opportunities with ESPN. I had opportunities with Fox. You know, it was sort of a challenge for me at the time to really say, you know, I've got this set of priorities right now, and I'm going to kind of take, you know, a real step away and figure out some other things in life. And among that time frame, I also, you know, got involved in things that I thought were going to be ways to, you know, define myself in ways other than as a baseball player. And that's some of the things that you mentioned from the sort of the business and media type of opportunities, which, you know what, were probably things that I needed to go through, but were certainly also learning lessons. And I paid steeply for that education at times, and really, you know, was kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I mean, when you're a Major League Baseball player, even the ones with the greatest, most successful careers, you know, money aside, you end a career that starts at 2 years old or 3 years old for a lot of guys. If you're lucky at 35 to 40 years old, and then you do have this big, big chunk of your life, hopefully, left to figure out how to navigate. And I don't know that there's any great lessons for that you can teach somebody when they're young, besides, you know, kind of the life experience that that happens when you're put into that position. So that life experience took me a lot of different ways. And, you know, I mentioned my wife, Kristen, at the induction, and I do credit her for really encouraging me. I was going to say pushing me, but really encouraging me to embrace my role as a Major League Baseball player and my life that I had dedicated to being in the game, and to take the opportunities that were still at some level being presented to me and love it, embrace it, you know, kind of lean into it with some passion. And that's really, I think, why I was able to sort of incrementally, step by step, get myself a little bit more involved with the Mets, a little bit more involved with the Mets broadcast team, a little bit more time in New York. And all of those things led to me doing something now that I've been fortunate enough to be awarded with an Emmy for my work on SNY. And it's something that I think more than anything, I really love to do. I realize I've missed the game during that sort of 10-year hiatus, if you will. And I also realize that it's okay to be associated with, you know, a kid's game, a sport, as an athlete, and that I didn't have to go out and, you know, try to create 10 other legacies for myself to sort of deny myself from being, you know, a quote, you know, jock.
You know, you mentioned being offered ESPN and Fox, and you have evidently settled on SNY, and you and Gary Apple do a fantastic job. I do want to ask you about that. You said you didn't prepare your speech at the Hall of Fame induction, but I guess you have to prepare somewhat for the broadcast. But specifically, how difficult it is to criticize a team that you're covering in when appropriate?
I think that, I mean, that's one of the nuances of what I do. And I think hopefully what the fan base and the players, quite honestly, feel like I do a good job of. I think I have a very critical eye for the game in a way that I love all the nuance of baseball. I think that's what makes it such a fascinating sport, and how you can really see 162 games and see 162 completely different presentations of this amazing sport. So because of that, I also have this perspective. I think that maybe is a little bit unique because I was a catcher from the time I could pick up a baseball and up until my second year in the big leagues. And then I had to learn what it was like to play in fair territory and be in the field looking back at the batter and sort of learn the game from a totally new perspective at the major league level. And I think that gave me a lot of respect and understanding of both sides of the ball from a pitching standpoint as a catcher and trying to work a game plan to a position player trying to be in the right position, trying to know what I'm doing mechanically and physically and how the game speeds up on you when you're in the infield and all of those things that I think gave me a very deep breadth of knowledge that I try to apply to the games I'm watching. And so that said, when guys are great, it's easy. You talk about the great things that they do. It's obvious. It's a television job. So the fans are seeing the same thing I'm seeing. What makes it unique and what I think gives me something that some of the fans and these critics and even the players have recognized to be a little bit unique is that I remember how hard it is to play this game. And I am never going to be a player that looks at a current player and thinks, oh, I could have done that, or I would have done that better, or he should have done this, or could have done that. You don't know unless you're in that moment. And I always keep that in not just the back of my mind, but even the forefront of my mind as I analyze. So when their errors are made. Guys are going to make errors. You recognize the errors. You point them out. Nobody means to make errors. When mental errors occur, you have to point out the mental errors. But I think what I try to do is recognize that I made a lot of mental errors in my games. I made a ton of physical errors when I played. I was never great all the time. And I think that level of humility maybe gives me that sort of pass with the players because I feel like I still have good relationships with the players, even though they must know at times I've had to be critical of their play on the field because there's times when the play on the field collectively deserves that level of critique. So hopefully I bring a perspective that points something out to a fan that they may not notice. It's something that I see because of the thousands and thousands of games that I played. But I try to find things that maybe they won't see instead of just pointing out, oh, he booted that ball, or God, how did he pop up that pitch, or something like that, to add to the context and the layer of why maybe that was that ball gave him trouble, or why maybe he's struggling right now when he's a better hitter than he's showing. So that's at least the perspective I take into it, and hopefully some of that comes across.
Well, as a viewer, we all appreciate it. I did want to follow up with one thing. The statistics today, has batting average, is that still important? I mean, we saw Pete Alonso 40 home runs, 100 and something RBIs, but a low batting average. I, as an old school guy, I still feel batting average is very important, but it seems like it's diminished these days. I want to know your thoughts.
I think as an old school guy, I recognize that, you know, when you're talking about baseball, a stat that has always been, you know, a measuring stick for success has been batting average. You talk about, you know, Ted Williams, the last 400 hitter in the major leagues, and Tony Gwynn, won batting titles hitting 360, and Wade Boggs was an amazing player winning batting title after batting title in the 340s. What I do actually believe, and this is something that is not as new as it seems, is that on-base percentage, I think, has as much of, you know, credence as a measuring stick as batting average. And I think that's the reason that people are saying batting average doesn't matter, because if you're a guy that hits 300, but your on-base percentage is 302 because you don't know, you never earned a walk in your life. And I played with a really great player in Sean Dunstan, who was a very good shortstop for the Chicago Cubs and a really talented athlete. And he, you know, worked to get his ninth walk of the season on the last day of the season. And we like stood, give him a standing ovation. Well, the point to that is he hit 301 that year and his bat and his on base percentage was maybe 5 points higher, you know, 310 or 315. And what does that mean? That means that you're really not getting on base as much as a guy that's got a 350, 360, 380, 400 on base percentage, which gives the opportunity for the guys behind him to knock him in, score more runs, cause more havoc on the bases for the defense. And so I do think that batting average has kind of taken a back seat to on base percentage. And then on base percentage with slug is the, you know, the OPS, and that's kind of the new barometer. And that I think can be overweighted. I think you look at OPS and it can be overweighted because I think there's a lot of really productive players that may not slug for, you know, and hit home runs at a clip, but can certainly get on base, cause havoc, score runs, create issues for the defense, get runners home. So on base percentage, I do believe is the better barometer, but you know, I pick and choose at some level, some of the analytics to really get the story for me of who that player is and how he differentiates himself from the other guys in the field.
Interesting.
So Todd, this question is not meant to cause any kind of controversy or anything, but I know that's always an ominous
that's
way
a good
to start,
preface.
Right? But Yankees got Juan Soto in a trade. Now,
yep.
Juan Soto at the end of this the next season will be a free agent. My thinking right away was because, you know, of course, the speculation starts, is he going to sign a long-term deal with them or is he going to be a rental player? And my first response was, well, he played for the Nationals, so he saw that organization. He played for San Diego, he saw that organization. I'm sure he's kind of heard about other organizations. Now he's going to the Yankees. And the Yankees, from everything you hear, is, you know, they're a classy organization. They do things right. And I thought he's going to get caught up in the whole whirlwind of being a Yankee and putting on the pinstripes. And then I started doing some research on your career, and you had a short stint with the Yankees. And there was a quote that said, you know, you didn't particularly enjoy being with the Yankee organization. So maybe being a Yankee isn't all it's cut out to be. So I just kind of wanted to ask you if you could just kind of tell us what it was about the Yankee organization that maybe you didn't care for.
Sure. And, you know, I know there's probably different quotes out there. By the way, Juan Soto, we'll start with that really quick. Great trade for the Yankees. They had to give up a ton to get him. I think the Mets are going to be in on him in free agency. I think he absolutely goes and takes a look at the market next year. He's with Boris. He already turned down $440 million from the Nationals. This guy's going to go see if he can get Ohtani type of money at the end of this year. So I think the Mets were never in on him. Just for Mets fans out there, I don't think they were ever in on him because it wasn't going to make sense for them to deplete their farm system for a rental in a year that they are not really all in on winning a championship. They're still building to win a championship in the next couple of years. So start with that on Soto. The statement that I made about the Yankee organization really had nothing to do with whether they were a great or a not great organization. It was about my experience as a Yankee, just to be clear. And what I said, it was probably the least fun or the my worst experience as a big leaguer in any organization. And it really had to do with the fact that I signed there really for one reason. I signed there because Joe Torre and I are very, very close. He's like a father to me. He came to me in the off season. He said, "Hey, I think you'd be a great fit here. Giambi's knee's bad. He's going to DH. I'm going to get you 400 to 500 at bats at first base. Robin, your buddy, is over at third base. And we've got a really good team. And this is going to be a fun place for you to play and love to be reunited again." And that was it for me. That's why I wanted to go there. The thing that made that different from, you know, best laid plans, as you know, was that Nick Johnson was the first baseman there that was on the market to be traded to the Montreal Expos for Javi Vasquez. That deal was essentially a done deal that was going to open up that ability for me to get the at-bats I was going to get at first base and have Robin at third, Jason DHing, and really kind of had the fit that we talked about. Well, just before spring training, Nick Johnson broke his hand in a winter workout, and the deal, the trade was nullified. When that trade was nullified, it meant, okay, Nick now has to go through spring training, get himself ready, and then get at bats day to day and be the guy every day to show that his hand is healthy and that he's productive so that they can resurrect that deal. So that took a lot of at bats away from me early in the season. And then it created a platoon role for Robin and me at third base to try to get me some at bats. But as you guys well know, a lot more right-handers in the game than left-handers. Mm-hmm. And so I was finding it hard for the first time in my career not to be playing every day. And at the end of the day, Nick Johnson was playing just fine at first base. And about the time that the deal was going to actually get consummated again, he got hit by a pitch and hurt his hand again and went down. And it took another 5 or 6 weeks for recovery and playtime to show that he was going to be healthy again. And by that time, we were deep into the season, and it just had started to get away from me. And Joe had to make decisions that were best for the team at that point and who was playing well. And I wasn't performing well. I had never been in a part-time role. I had never really adapted to it that well. And I think Robin and myself, our performance, both of our performance suffered in that platoon role. And we both ended up opting to get moved to different places to open up that slot and give us an opportunity to go and play every day. And he ended up in LA and was very, very happy there. And I ended up in Montreal and having a very, very fun run with a really young, you know, kind of energetic team that included Vladdy Guerrero and Will Cordero and guys that, you know, were hungry to win. So at the end of the day, those are the reasons that I was talking about. It really had nothing to do with the organization. It was a class organization. They treated me well. They gave me an opportunity to go somewhere that I wanted to go when my time was done there. And I have nothing but great respect for Joe as a friend and a mentor and a manager.
Yeah, you were, he was one of your managers along with a Hall of Famers, Whitey Herzog, Jim Leland, who's going in this year, and Frank Robinson was one of your managers as well. Yep. And of course, you were managed by Bobby V, as I mentioned earlier. I know we only have a few minutes left, and we thank you for your time. I just wanted to, I was doing some research on you, and you hit, like you said, over 250 home runs, 253 home runs off 195 different pitchers. But the most home runs you had off of was of Hall of Famer Tom Glavine, which at four. And you also hit him pretty well with a 326 average and a 929 OPS. You must have really liked, and didn't you catch him in your last game?
I did. We're gonna have to save this and send it to him. Yeah, you know what? Look, I played for a lot of different teams, so I played against a lot of different pitchers. A little different than if I had stayed in one organization and been seeing the same, you know, teams 19 times a year. I would have probably had more at-bats amassed against, you know, particular guys. But I always did have a fair amount of success against Tom. I saw him well, and I crowded home plate and didn't give him an opportunity to kind of pick that change up off the outside corner. I could cover that being so close to the plate, and he didn't love to throw inside. So once in a while when he did, I would guess right. And I was able to, you know, to get the barrel to one. So, but you know, the other point to that is that it was great to be a teammate of his, because we were very, you know, friendly during the course of our careers, because we were both longtime members of the Players Association and on the executive committee and the negotiating committee. And so I spent time with Tom and knew how thoughtful and smart he was in the strategies of the game. Always had great respect for him as a pitcher, but, you know, did get the opportunity to catch him in my final game in the big leagues. And, you know, it was something that I asked Art Howe, who was managing, if I could go out the way I came in. I said, look, I really still feel like a catcher, even though I played 2,000 games at third. And I'd love to go out the way I came in. And he said, hey, it's good by me. You've got to clear it with the starting pitcher. And the starting pitcher that day is going to be Glavine. And I said, no problem. So I went to Tom. I told him. He said, no problem. We started catching some bullpens and getting myself ready. And you know, that was actually a thrill, and he had a good game and got, I think, picked up a win that day. And, you know, I ended my tenure with a home run and with a catch of, you know, Johnny Franco's last pitch as a Met.
Right.
So, you know, it was a great ending for me, and I'm glad that I could do it from behind the plate and that Glav was a part of that.
Well, that was fantastic. You had a fantastic career. I know we're out of time. Thank you very much. I also want to mention your second game, you hit a home run. So you hit a home run in your second game and then your very last at bat. So you did pretty well. 253 home runs is pretty, pretty good. So, and congratulations. You know,
I'm just saying, since you mentioned that, the irony of the two home runs early, you know, first couple of games in the big leagues, I hit a home run against a UCLA alum, friend of mine, Tim Leary. And then the final at bat against somebody that I had been a teammate of the year before, Claudio Vargas. But that said, those two home runs were very similar in the trajectory. They went out fast on a line and hit off the facade of the second deck and bounced back to the field. So those are the only two home runs of my 253 home runs that I still was able to get, because they ricocheted right back onto the field and they were thrown in to the dugout. I think my final one was the Expos. Obviously, those were guys that I was friends with. They recognized it as my last at bat. They got that home run ball into the dugout before I even got around to home plate. So irony, have those two, but that's good bookends, I guess.
That's fantastic. Todd, thank you so much. Congratulations again on the New York State Baseball Hall of Fame, and we appreciate you being on Baseball and BBQ.
Anytime, guys. My pleasure. Thanks for getting me back on.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings Podcast, and if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Lynn. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out, Baseball and BBQ with Lynn and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
Thank you, Todd Zeal, for joining us on Baseball and BBQ. I really enjoyed that. I learned a lot of stuff, too, on that interview.
Yeah, from the newest inductee of the New York State Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, and we mentioned it in the interview. For him to give a speech like that off the cuff was quite impressive. It really was. You know what else is impressive, Jeff?
What's that?
BaseballBBQ.com.
Oh.
Yeah. You can get baseball bat handled, tongs, spatulas, forks, so many items, cutting board shaped like home plate. You could get engraved whatever you want on them. Head to BaseballBBQ.com. It's getting close to grilling season. You don't want to be caught without some trusty tools.
And if you want to reach the show, give us a call, 516-855-8214. Email us, baseballandbbq@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our Facebook page, Baseball and BBQ. We have a Twitter or an X at Baseball and BBQ. Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue, where barbecue is all spelled out. Our website is www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. Please rate, review, and you know we're on all your podcast apps.
Jeff, after listening to our next guest, everybody's going to know the correct way to spell curveball. Let's just say that. Here is Monica Bedlani and Curveball Whiskey.
Does whiskey and barbecue go together? You bet your bippy it does. And Curveball Whiskey is the original barbecue whiskey. Often described as tasting of ribs or barbecue chips, Curveball can be enjoyed as a cold shot in mixed drinks and in culinary applications. Curveball Whiskey is gluten-free and proudly American-made. To talk to us about Curveball Whiskey is the Chief Business Officer, Monica Bedlani. Welcome, Monica.
Welcome.
Thank you, Jeff. Pleasure to be here. Hey, Leonard.
Hi. So before we get started, I just want everybody to know, because we have, you know, we have baseball fans that listen and we have barbecue fans. And when they hear Curveball Whiskey, I want them to know that it's spelled the right way, which is K-U-R-V-B-A-L-L. Not the other way. The other way is wrong.
That is correct. We say curveball with the K. So, yep.
So that leads me to my first question is, where'd that name come from?
Well, it's funny because, you know, curveball in general, we created it sort of during COVID. And it is literally, you can imagine people sitting around a room thinking through things and like coming up with ideas. We sort of really wanted to create a unique flavored whiskey. And, you know, we were coming up with the normal stuff, right? Everything that's out there is sort of a little bit sweet. It's like, you know, apple or peach or cinnamon. And then someone sort of said barbecue, and someone else was like, that's a curveball. And it just together, it was just sort of like, that's it. You know, you sort of that eureka moment and you sort of knew. And so then we started thinking through how to sell it. And what the angle would be, would it be barbecue? Would it be baseball? And what was so funny about it was the name curveball spelled the incorrect way was already taken by a beer company. And those are the kinds of things that you like look back and say, thank goodness, because we were working out with our designer and we had put the K on and he said, can I take out the E? So it's curveball with the K and without the E, and it just looks beautiful on that bottle. So we are so grateful that the other spelling was taken.
Yeah, and no, it really does. And Jeff's enjoying a glass there. He's you could see his cheeks. His cheeks getting a little rosy. Now, Monica, you were I don't know if this company has anything to do with the other company.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know you were involved with an adult beverage company. So this is an offshoot of that?
Yeah. So the other company is called Somras. And so that's actually where we gained our chops developing flavors in the alcohol world and, you know, sort of figuring out the right distributors to work with, figuring out the right buyers, the right retail places, retail chains. And so what ended up happening was very naturally during COVID, we had this amazing team and that, you know, on-premise was shut down and we were pretty sad about it because those are like our brothers and sisters. And so we originally were trying to figure out what to do to support them. And so we started doing things like to-go cocktail kits and that kind of stuff that they could sort of sell and make some money. And, you know, that's when we got a bunch of encouragement. We sort of raised some funds and, you know, you guys are pretty innovative. And so we said, yeah, we are. So curveball just came out of that group being a little bored during COVID, being very appreciative of, you know, we all mostly in Chicago and just loving sort of, you know, being here where we were taken care of, you know, quite well, I'd say. And so it was that same group that created this product.
I got to tell you, it really stands out from other whiskeys because of that smoky flavor that you had infused in them. Could you tell us the secret? How's that done?
Yeah, I can't tell you the secret because then all of a sudden you're going to have a barbecue flavored whiskey. But I can tell you, right, so there's a balance there of smoke and sweet and barbecue flavor. This has, you know, you mentioned it sort of tastes like ribs or barbecue chips. It really sort of does. It doesn't have like any of the vinegariness of you know, of a barbecue sauce, for example. It's pure sort of smoke, barbecue, and sweetness. And so it took us actually a really long time. We kept on, you know, sort of iterating and we had time. Mm-hmm. The great thing about, you know, being the first one to launch this is no one else had, you know, developed a liquid. We weren't trying to catch up to somebody else. And so we, you know, we were like, let's just keep on iterating until we get the right formula because it'll be harder for someone to replicate it. And so it's sort of a 9-step process. It's pretty elaborate to create this thing. Very purposely, we wanted it to be tough, but we also wanted like when you're drinking it, we want you to say, oh, how'd they make this? You know, and we like that reaction. So we don't give away the secret sauce, I'll say,
sure.
But we really do appreciate when people come back and sort of, you know, say, how was this made? This is pretty good. So we really appreciate that.
And you mentioned that you rolled it out nationally. It looks like I'm doing the research in 2023 during World Food Championships.
Yeah,
how did that go, and how was that received?
Yeah, no. So we, so wonderful. You guys really do your homework. So what had happened before then? I mean, you know, it takes, you know, overnight successes take 10 years, and all of a sudden you've heard about it. So we, you know, we officially sort of did a press release around the World Food Championships, you know, last fall. because by that time we'd only been in the market about a little over a year and a half, and we had finally launched all 50 states. I think you guys know in the alcohol world, it's pretty tough because you got to have a distributor and you got to have the right distributor and you got to have, it's almost like a marriage, right? You got to sort of have a good business case for them. You got to see if they've got the space, but also if they talk to the right buyers. We want to get into a Walmart. Well, we got to make sure our distributor has that relationship. And so we took, you know, some time first sort of testing the market, I'd say, in 2022. Getting a handful of really good distributors. And then we're very honored, but we got very lucky to get sort of the ear of Southern Wine and Spirits, which is the largest national distributor. And we started a conversation with them in March. And by June, we had a national agreement and they cover over 40 states. And so we spent the rest of the year getting those up and running. And so when we say we launched, we wanted that to be at the time, even though we had launched, you know, 6 months before, we wanted that to be at the time that a consumer could find it in their state. Because it doesn't really, you know, consumer doesn't care about a distributor or even about us. You know, they want to just see it in their local stores. And so that's when we sort of feel like we really launched the brand.
Monica, I see that it's launched, or it, has it been launched yet in the UK?
Oh, that's interesting. We've been getting a lot of requests from the UK, from Australia, and from Canada. And so what are you seeing?
Well, I saw an article, and as I'm reading it, it mentions that it will be in the UK. And I was like, oh, okay. So I didn't know if it's there yet or it's going to be.
I think you are officially announcing it on your podcast. Yeah, so we are
I'm breaking my story.
You guys are pretty good news people. So good journalists, investigative journalism. We literally, I think it's been even less than a month, a few weeks ago, been getting a lot of requests. And, you know, we do have a really fantastic UK partner who is sort of pitching for us to bring it in earlier. We really wanted to focus on the US for a few years, but, you know, it's an American brand, right? But we are getting sort of, you know, barbecue seems to have barbecue aficionados, and everyone has their love affair with barbecue around the world. And so we are contemplating just a handful of places, and UK is the first. So I will keep you guys posted so you can tell your consumer, your fan base.
You know, it's funny because when something's on the internet and you have to look at the date, there are things that have been on there for years and years. And this one actually says 3 weeks ago. So
yes.
I didn't realize. So it is very new. I think it'll do well over there. They, you know, they do like their beverages.
they sure do. They sure do. And I think that, you know, it's fun for us because if you think around the world, like people do grill their meats in different ways. They have their own barbecue sauces. It's, you know, it's quite fun. And they may not call it that, but this sweet, smoky, savory, you know, we're the first sort of savory flavored whiskey out there, right? Which we can talk about, you know, as well. But I think that that combination, it hits multiple different senses and our multiple different taste buds. And I think people are really enjoying that.
Now, Jeff and I go to a lot of barbecue events. And one of the things you see a lot, and I mean, you were the sponsor, the official whiskey sponsor of the 2023 World Food Championships. And when we go to these, there's always tables where they have, whether it's hard seltzers or whatever the drinks are. Do you have to do that? Do you have people that just their specific jobs or part of it is going to all these different events, setting up tables, giving samples?
Sure. Yeah. So I'll tell you the reason why. So if I tell you, you know, say you haven't heard of Curveball and I say, you know what, I got a barbecue flavored whiskey. What goes through your minds when you guys first heard about it? What went through your mind? Both, you know, positive or constructive. What were your first thoughts?
I thought maybe you can use it in barbecue sauces, you know, as a glaze, you know, drinking obviously as a straight whiskey, but many uses.
I thought that it would kind of taste a little like Sweet Baby Ray's. But I also had read some people talking about it online, so I let that kind of, I didn't think a lot about what it would be. I read the things, but yeah, like a sauce or something like that. Yeah, definitely.
Did you say, you know, barbecue and whiskey, I'm curious about, like, I think that sometimes people just can't put the two together originally, like at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. Oh yeah. It's an it's an interesting combination. Yes.
And so we love the curveball name because people are like, yeah, it sort of is a curveball. But what you were getting at, which is, you know, really important to us, is getting it in people's mouths, because then they have no, you know, then they're like, oh yes, I want more. Please get me more. And so being at the right events is really important to us. You know, at the same time, you know, the events, what we really like to see is after the event, a handful of people sort of sharing it with their friends. Or even, you know, we've got a pretty active community on social. And so, you know, I'll tell you guys about this next, but we've named our logo the Bonehead. So I'll tell you a little bit about that story in a second. And so we've launched the Bonehead Nation, which is like anyone who just wants to be part of our, you know, of our crew. And so, you know, what we're finding is that people are really enjoying, you know, like they're having fun either shooting it, everything from shooting it to making, you know, a sauce with it, like a beer or even a Red Bull, let's say. But so we just coined this phrase, which we sort of love, which is shoot it, sauce it, sink it. And it came from our consumers. And so that's, if you really listen to your consumers, like doing these trade shows, I think is really one avenue, but everyone loves a free beverage.
Sure.
So sometimes you don't always get like the honest feedback that you really want.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And what I really find is online, you really get, people are, you know, very used to reviewing. We're very lucky that we have quite a few, you know, positive engagements online, but they'll tell you what they're thinking. They'll tell you like the answer to how you brand it, or, you know, what age range, or how it's being utilized. And so we do like doing tastings, but we're really like online, just watching online.
That's like, you know, that's like when you're looking for product reviews and you go, let's say it's Amazon, and then it tells you either that the person's an actual purchaser, or sometimes it says it was part of a free giveaway promotion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And nobody's going to complain if it's part of a giveaway promotion. I mean, come on.
That's right. I feel like very few of them, like every now and then they'll be like, well, you know, we love, love, love this. If there was one thing I had to change, and they might say something, but you're right. It's like, it's a very biased, positive, you know, very natural positive bias. And so, you know, we really appreciate sort of the value of the internet. The one thing that we do find at events is when someone will bring their friend over, and their friend will be like, oh, I don't want to try barbecue whiskey. And then they give it to them and they're like, oh, and they become our biggest, you know, fan, right, because they didn't think they were going to like it. And, you know, they really, really liked it. And so they'll bring in 10 more people. That we like seeing a lot, which does happen. So that's quite fun.
Sure. And if anybody wants to join Bonehead Nation, which I did a couple of days ago, you go to Curveball Whiskey, and I'm going to spell it out for you. Curveball whiskey.com. And just go in, and like I tell people, you got to be 21 or over.
Yes.
Give them the click the 21 and over, and you can get in and join Bonehead Nation, just like I did. You know, Monica, we go to we speak to a lot of competitive pitmasters, and many create their own sauce.
Yes.
Them using Curveball whiskey give them an edge in the barbecue contests.
It does. So I don't know if you guys saw this, but as World Food Competition 2023, we actually had a curveball challenge. And so we said, okay, listen, we want to see what you guys are, you know, doing with this. And we made it open so that you could submit everything from a drink to a glaze, you know, to a dessert, whatever you wanted to do. And I think people had a lot of fun with it. And that's what we really want to also see, is that, you know, pitmasters are like the kings and queens of, you know, the barbecue world, right? Like, the really good ones have a following. They literally, people will line up at 6 a.m. to get there. You know, get their brisket, and it's until it's sold out, right? And so we know the value of the pit masters accepting something that's barbecue flavored, because that to us is sort of the holy grail. You know, I think that we don't want to just be for barbecue fans alone. We want to be for anyone who loves barbecue, I'd say. And so the pit masters sort of giving us their seal of approval has been happening quite a bit. And we are very, very honored to have that. And then, you know, I think something, it's one of those things that can be like an easy, you know, 2 or 3 ingredient thing, because we have a lot of the stuff that they already use in there. They can make a lot with it. And so we find a lot of fun innovation, you know, everything from the simple, you know, wing sauces and that kind of, and rib glazes and that kind of stuff, all the way up to like someone's making, you know, sort of, we got this great idea from a pitmaster, but that, you know, they were just sort of as a break for them, they were doing a curveball shot with a slice of pickle, like a pickle chip. And it was such an interesting, fun, easy way to consume it. It's like a flavor explosion. So now that you guys have some curveball, just try it with a pickle at the end. If you feel like you're having a full-on barbecue meal, it is such a fun shot. It is absolutely my favorite way to, you know, consume it. And so I think, you know, to your point, we love just hearing what the pit masters are up to and what they're doing. And, you know, if you're a pit master and you join Barbecue Nation, Bonehead Nation, or if you're a fan of the show, just drop us a quick email when you sign up for Bonehead Nation and just say that you heard about us through here, and we'll keep you posted with some fun stuff throughout the year.
Nice. So Monica, if somebody wants to find you guys throughout the year, what are some of the events that you will be at?
So, no, that's a great question. We actually haven't finalized too many of our events because a lot of them happen in the summer. So I would just check back on our social. So, you know, we're on Instagram and Facebook, of course, and it'll sort of tell folks where we're at. But and at the same time, you can just ask your local liquor store when they're doing a tasting, because what will happen is that we'll naturally have them ask us when we're doing a tasting. And so we will schedule a tasting. So if there's enough demand somewhere, we'll do an event at a store and you can taste it there. And if you like it, you can buy it right there. And so we really like that too, because we like to help the retailers. They're our you know, biggest advocates too, right? And so if you want a tasting in your area, just drop us an email and tell us that you'd love that, or even better, that you've talked to a liquor store and, you know, they'd like to have a tasting.
You can find it. There's some stores to, and we'll ask you about that and you'll tell us all that. But what about if I go to my local bar?
Mm-hmm.
When will I see Curveball on what is it? Top shelf, right?
Yes, exactly. No, it's a great, great question. So we do have on curveballwhiskey.com a where to find us, and it should have both. It might be a little bit lagged because we are going in so quickly. We're sort of growing day by day, but it should have both bars and retail stores. So you can look on there and see where are we currently. And, you know, I think that if you think a bartender would love to hear about us, again, you know, we're very open to making sure our distributor stops by with samples, or we can send samples here if we're sort of local. But I think that that's what's happening, is that people are sort of spreading the word because they want, to your question, right, they want Curveball at their local bar. And so, you know, we really love that. That is like the biggest, you know, honor for us to hear that, hey, you know, please have this bar carry it. So, and then we do drink specials and stuff like that to help the bar announce that they are now carrying Curveball.
Great. That's great promotions. You know, I want to follow up what Len said, and you're talking about events, because on your website, you will be at the South Beach Food and Wine Food Festival in Miami.
Oh, my goodness.
In February.
I forgot about that. We absolutely will be there. That is correct. Thank you for mentioning that. That's a really big event. So, you know, we're with Southern Wine and Spirits in Florida, and that is an event that they host. It's a really nice event. So if any of your listeners, you know, go there, please stop by the booth and tell the folks that are at the booth that you heard about it on this show, and we'll give you something a little extra special. So it's a fun event.
You have a great website. It's very easy to go to. It's curveballwhiskey.com, curveballwhiskey.com. There's recipes on the site, merchandise. Even as I'm saying this, I'm making sure that then it says buy now. It says need more? We strongly encourage you to visit our valued retail partners at their store locations. And there's a map there with tons of, of, you know, those pins on it. So
Yes. Yeah, we are growing quite quickly. So that we try to update that at least once a week if we can, you know. So, you know, I think that is there. But I think that, you know, our distributor sales force has quite a few people that are out there sort of promoting Curveball on a daily basis. They are always happy to stop by a warm lead. So, you know, by all means, you know, send that sort of our way. We do want within a couple of years, people not having to, we get email requests every day. Where can I find Curveball in this zip code? And it's quite fun to sort of, that's where we put the map together, right? And we try to manage that. every now and then we'll get a zip code where there's no store in that map. And so we're able to add it because we've got national coverage now. So that's really, really nice. I was telling you guys real quick, I went back to the story behind Bonehead Nation was, again, you know, we were trying to figure out our logo. And so you see it's sort of this Jolly Roger type logo with the barbecue, tools behind it. And we were just cracking up because we were like, I think during COVID, everyone got to take a breather. And so we just started saying, we want to live life in the slow lane. We want to, you know, sort of not take ourselves too seriously. And so we came up with this really fun, you know, the Bonehead, right? And it's a way to do that. It's a way to sort of live, enjoy life a little bit more. And so on our website, if you join the Bonehead Nation, we do more than just sort of announce things. We might do events. People might come together and say, hey, we want to support this cause. And we're really, you know, big on that as well. We've supported Operation Barbecue. We are going to launch an initiative. I'll announce it here for the first time since you guys are great investigative journalists. But
breaking news.
Breaking news. We're going to launch something. Again, this is sort of from our community called Curve Hunger. So K-U-R-V Hunger. And, you know, that's a pretty big problem in this country still, especially during the cold. And so we will be launching that and looking for, you know, partners, people to support that next year. So that'll be part of the Bonehead Nation initiatives next year. Oh, sorry, this year. It's already 2024.
That's right.
So we can have a lot of fun, right? That community could be a give back community. It could be a social community. It can be whatever we create from it. And so we want it to be broader than just the Curveball brand.
But Monica, you say it's American made. It's, I think, bottled in Wisconsin, if I'm correct.
Yes, yes, that's correct. And we are actually moving that. So again, you guys are on the breaking news of everything, it seems. we're going to be starting to bottle it in Bardstown, Kentucky.
Okay.
So it's going to be made. It actually already is made with bourbon is one of our, one of our secrets, but I can share that piece of it. And so we're already using bourbon from Kentucky that's currently being shipped over to Wisconsin. And we will now be, sort of using Kentucky bourbon plus bottling it in Kentucky pretty soon.
But so, you don't have to move, right?
No, but I wouldn't mind during these Chicago weathers, right? So it's going to be a snowstorm today. So I would not mind being somewhere a little bit warmer.
So educate our listeners, our novice listeners who don't know much about whiskey, best place to store it, best uses for it, any suggestions of how to use mixed drinks or drink it straight?
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun because I think we're a little bit a little bit less serious whiskey, right? Anything that's flavored is going to naturally be, first of all, lower alcohol with it. So we are at a 68 proof, 34% alcohol. And what that does is, you know, I think it very simply, it masks the burn. You don't really get the alcohol burn from this, right? And part of that is to have the right flavor profile, all that stuff. So for us, you know, if you normally drink a whiskey sort of neat without any ice or any water, you can drink this guy neat. You also do not ever need water because it already is, you know, sort of a lower proof. And then I think that for people who like cocktails or more importantly shots, it is a fantastic chilled shot. And like I said, try that chilled shot with that pickle chip on the back end. You will feel like it's a very simple thing to say, but you'll feel a completely different experience. And then, you know, I think that the easiest drinks to make with it, to be very honest with you, are an old fashioned, which just put a couple of dashes of bitters in here and it tastes like an old fashioned, which is really easy and nice because it already has a bunch of the ingredients in an old fashioned. And then, honestly, if you like smoky cocktails, so anywhere where you might put mezcal, for example, you could do a margarita and do barbecue whiskey instead of the tequila or the mezcal. It works incredibly well. And then we've seen, you probably see this on our website, but we've seen people use it in a Bloody Mary and make a barbecue Bloody, which is quite fun because we're then going beyond whiskey and we're going into, you know, vodka territory. So it's quite fun.
And the best place to store it is in a dark place, right? Cool, dark place?
Yeah. So best place to store is cool, dark. Although again, like I think it doesn't change as much, right? And so I think you can, as long as it's not in bright sunlight, you can keep it out, you know, on your home bar. Or you're going to be grabbing for it every day. You're going to be missing your ball whiskey. So I think, you know, I think that some of those, no, I think nothing's too cold. And then you're right. You don't want it to get too hot, right? So
right. No, it's. I'm telling you, I'm drinking it now, and it is delicious. So I'm not just saying that because it really is. I did feel that smoky flavor, which I enjoy.
Yeah, no, thank you. It's quite fun. I think that what's also fun is just smelling it, and you get that like, oh yeah, it smells like barbecue, right? So you'd be surprised that like part of our iteration was even getting the right smell, because smell can mm-hmm. impact flavor so much, right? So that's an important piece of it as well.
So I was looking on your website. You know, you did say you have the map there, and I know it's concentrated more in the mid-United States.
Yes.
So we're in New York.
Yes.
So if people wanted to get it from you, just go onto your website and go to the buy now on top and click that, and you'll ship it anywhere.
That's right. So a couple of things. You're absolutely correct that right now we've been in the Midwest the longest, so we're the biggest here. So we need everyone's help on the coasts to just sort of walk into their stores and say, hey, I want it, or hop on the website and get it. And the backup, I know if you know, everyone wants instant gratification. For me, I want to walk into my store and get it tonight, right? But the backup is that we do have several online partners, and so you can get it shipped to you as well.
Cool.
Monica, they say there's no original ideas. I would argue with some of that, but of course I was thinking, well, you actually have a recipe online for how to use this and make your own barbecue sauce. Mm-hmm. So of course I thought to myself, well, what if you guys, do you ever have any idea, or maybe this is an idea, where you have curveball whiskey sauce, because it is kind of a sauce, right?
Yes.
Or curveball whiskey barbecue sauce. And then I remembered being in the store and I saw like a Budweiser barbecue sauce or something. And I looked, and there is, you know, Budweiser sauce, but I have no idea how it is or what. I mean, this is yours is, you know, that I don't know. Budweiser sauce is not
right. I mean,
they're not listening, but I'm just saying yours has the elements of barbecue in it, so it will enhance a sauce and make a good sauce. So any idea, any thoughts on that? Did I just give you an idea that I'm going to want
a little? You didn't copyright it, so it's my idea, right? So no, yes, we clearly, like, I mean, I think it's fun because you can just sort of even add it to your favorite, you know, sauce today and make this really fun. Like it just elevates the sauce. Right. Yeah. I think, you know, we're generally, what we want to do is we want to be open to that idea, like the ideas that have staying power, right? We also want to stay focused. So for right now, right, my focus is all of your listeners who want to get curveball can actually walk into their local store and get it. And right, that takes some time. And so, you know, we will contemplate. I mean, that idea, of course, is such a natural, you know, fit for it, right? And we do know there's some other whiskey brands that have done some sauces. We think that we know we taste great, right, in the sauce. So, but I think that's part of the fun too, is that people actually can create their own sauces and sort of if we keep on seeing it show up online, we know it has legs, right? But for right now, my team is super focused on just getting it into right, stores, getting it into bars.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I just popped in my head. How large is your team? How large is Curveball Whiskey's team?
Yes, no, that's a great question. So we are pretty small, I'll say. We are 16 people total, and 12 of us are in Chicago, and then we've got a handful of people around the country. And really, the reason that we can be so small is that we also have great partners. So a lot of our sales force is the distributor and their ability to sort of go out and sell on our behalf. Now, having said that, my team works incredibly hard. And so, you know, people always ask us, people in the industry, how big is your team? And they can't believe that, you know, we're still doing all the marketing and branding in-house. We're still doing a lot of the tastings that you talk about, right? We're sort of still organizing that. We're directing the strategy of the distributors. And so, you know, we are a pretty effective team, I'll say. We're pretty much, you know, we know how to brainstorm quickly. We know how to iterate. For example, we see something like the Curveball Pickle Shot online, and within 2 days, we've tested it out. And within a week, we've got new sell sheets to our distributor. So we are very quick and nimble, but pretty small, versatile team.
Monica, I saw something online talking about the process, which is quite a complex process. I mean, of just making whiskey. And so, and then the one thing that it said was, we're not going to reveal how many years it ages or how long it ages.
Yeah.
But is longer aging, the longer a whiskey's aged, what does that do to it?
So a couple of things it does to it, right? Which may or may not impact a flavored whiskey, right? So a regular whiskey, you're going to impart pretty much the flavors of the barrel. So you guys know, bourbon is aged in charred oak barrels. So the charring and the oak will sort of result in flavors seeping into the whiskey over time. And so it changes the complexity of the whiskey, right? There are, whiskeys around the world, like Japanese whiskeys, that are aged in a variety of different barrels. They might actually be aged in old bourbon barrels. They use a different type of oak there, right? And so it has almost like sort of the terroir for wine. It has that similar thing for whiskey. It might be of that, region. For us, it's interesting because what ends up happening is you age it, which we like to do. And from our perspective, the aging pretty much makes it, and I know people sort of think about this a lot, but makes it a little bit easier to blend and smooth. It's the right aging that mixes with, because we clearly have to put flavoring to make it a flavored whiskey, right? It's the aging that mixes well with all the other ingredients out there that I'm not going to mention. So good job for trying to make me disclose.
Have ways of making talk.
We did try, and that again, like we went through 9 iterations of Curveball, or sorry, 9 steps to create Curveball. Each of them had iterations, and which base of whiskey was part of that. So yes.
Monica, that as you're talking about the barrel, and of course this is, you call me Captain Obvious here, but barbecue relies on wood, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
The wood the wood you use is accent on the food.
That's right.
Whiskey relies on the wood, the barrel, and right?
I like that. Yes.
Wow.
Fantastic. Now you've given me a new marketing angle. No, that is absolutely correct. That's what makes it feel a little bit more real and genuine, right? And so I think that the wood flavor, because think about it, you wouldn't want to taste a wood flavored whiskey. That would sound weird to you, right? But that's actually what's happening when they're aging it. So I think that is correct, that, it enhances the barbecue-ness of the whiskey.
Yeah.
I like it.
Monica, we really appreciate your time. Thank you very much. This was very educational.
Thank you, guys.
Just terrific. Could you please, before you go, let us know all your social media so people can get in touch and join Bonehead Nation.
Yes. So as you mentioned, so our website is curveballwhiskey.com, curveball with a K, K-U-R-V-B-A-L-L, whiskey with an E.com. On there, you can join Bonehead Nation to stay up to tune with all the stuff that we're doing and to get freebies every now and then. And then also on our website, you'll see the where to buy. You'll also see the social handles. And so we're on Instagram and Facebook. I actually think that we're probably on YouTube. We're just sort of launching YouTube as well. But all those should just be curveballwhiskey.com. Curveball Whiskey is the handle as well.
And you're also on X or Twitter or whatever.
That is correct. Yes.
Which is actually kind of appropriate because the Jolly Roger kind of has, right? And X marks the spot. It's a pirate map.
Yeah.
Boy, am I just, Monica, I'm going to.
You have a job in marketing.
That's what I'm. Well, we'll talk. We'll talk later.
You guys got my number, so give me a call. Such a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Monica. I think they're really onto something,
It was very good. I'm telling you, it was really good.
Yeah. And you could drink it. You could use it in recipes. I mean, it's limitless. So, and I love did you drink it with a pickle, Jeff?
I did not drink it with a pickle. I went straight whiskey.
So now you got to try it with the pickle.
Okay. Leonard.
Yes.
Super Bowl is tomorrow. We're dropping this on Saturday. Super Bowl is Sunday. And I don't know if anybody's going to be listening to this afterwards. I hope they do. But who's your Super Bowl prediction? And we'll know whether you're right or wrong on Monday.
You're asking me? You want me to pick? I'm going to say the Chiefs.
You are? Okay.
Yes. That's my pick. I think the Chiefs are going to win.
Okay.
And who do you think?
I just want my two numbers to come in. I never win those box pools. I never win.
So you're not going to make a prediction on the game?
Well, I think I agree with you. I think the Chiefs will win. They are right now. They are the top team in football the last couple of years, and they're champions until someone dethrones them. So
yeah. So you know, Jeff, we usually give two great guests. We say goodbye. We thank our guests, and then we play our song. But we're going to have a third guest. But before we do that, you've got something for us.
The quote of the week.
Baseball is the only sport I know that when you're on offense, the other team controls the ball. That was Ken Hawk Harrelson, who was a player and a broadcaster.
Yep. Thank you very much. And now, Jeff, we're going to get to Brian Scala with Eddie, the legend. Our next guest is the perfect example of being in the right place at the right time. I happened to meet our guest at a dinner. It was at work function, and had no idea that he was a writer. And somehow, I think I probably brought up the podcast first or something. And then I find out he's a writer. And then I find out that he's a big Met fan, and that his book, Eddie the Legend, is filled with Mets references and baseball. And it's fiction, but there's a lot of truth in this book. We are very honored to welcome to the podcast Brian Scala. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, that was quite serendipitous, that little work dinner that we attended.
Right? I had no idea. That's the thing. If you don't talk to people, you don't know, right?
Yeah. And like you said, it just so happened. I don't know how it came up in conversation, just chit-chatting. And
right. You know. Well, the truth is I always bring up the podcast. I mean, we could be talking about, dirt in a garden. Somehow I feel, the vegetables that grow in a garden, they can go on a barbecue, and that barbecue could be eaten by baseball players. Yeah, I come up with something.
Yeah, it's and nowadays I feel like I try to work in the conversation the fact that I'm an author.
And you should. That's exactly. And let's get to that. You've written a number of books, but we're going to focus on Eddie the Legend. Jeff, first impressions of Eddie the Legend.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed the book, even though it's a work of fiction. There's a lot of baseball background in it, which I really enjoyed. I didn't think it's going to take me to the Mets because we're talking about Seattle and Cleveland, but eventually we get to New York and talk about the Mets. One thing I did notice in here, which I had a bookmark because you write that someone wanted to be an announcer, and they said you're at Citi Field or Shea Stadium, and says that's Jack Franchetti, who was the public address announcer. Sidebar, I used to be an intern for the Mets in 1984, and one of my jobs was to go into the announcer's booth and say to Jack Franchetti, so-and-so is pinch-hitting for so-and-so. And yeah, so that's, it's truthful stuff in this book.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to, mix in as much of, reality as, and like you said, it is a fictional story, but I believe that, some of the best fictional stories are based on reality, and I tried to make it as believable as possible, and what better way than to mix in some actual events that coincide with the fictional events.
Like I said, I don't want to give it away. It's very easy when we have authors that are not writing fiction, because we're not giving anything away, right? But right. In this case, I don't want to give too much away. So the book is called Eddie the Legend, and there is a group of friends in the book, and they are all Met fans, big Met fans.
Yeah, that's sort of their common interest. That's what brings them together. They were all part of a bowling league, and they just happened to find each other. They're all Met fans, and things happened during the pandemic. The bowling was shut down, and so they decided, they needed another place and time to meet and to talk about, their what they love.
So basically, they're sadists.
Well, yeah, I suppose that if you are a Met fan, that you are to an extent a glutton for punishment.
Yes.
Now, Brian, somebody reading this that's not from this area, because you happen to be right now, probably I could, I'd have to have a really good arm. I could throw a rock to a mile from your house. You're not far.
Nice. No, no, I live in Levittown, Long Island.
Yeah. And a lot of references to Long Island in this book.
I right, mean, right.
The so, restaurants. Yeah.
So Leonard lives in Belmore. I live in Wantagh. You live just north of us in Levittown. So reading the book, at least us, we're familiar with all these places you are talking about. I mean, I had dinner at Domenico's last month. So it's just
that's one of our favorite places. And in fact, I have a friend who lives down in Florida, used to live up here. And, you know, she read the book and she said something like, oh, my God, you referenced King Cullen. I haven't heard that name in years. It's incredible.
Yeah. Talk about the Southern State, the Throgs Neck Bridge. It's all in this book. So if people want to know about Long Island, at least Nassau County.
But also in the beginning of the book, it's Seattle. So it's all on the different side of the country, which we get a different scene. So why did you pick Seattle to like open the book?
Well, it's for number one, I lived in Seattle for a little while. When I was in my mid-30s, I had moved out there. I left Long Island and just, you know, wanted to see another part of the country, and got a job out there. And I picked the absolute wrong time to move to Seattle. I moved there in August, and so I had like 2 months of sunshine, and then it was pretty much drizzling, raining for the rest of the 8 months that I was living there. But it's a beautiful place to visit in the summer. I've been there numerous times. You know, I have a friend who's a baseball fan as well. We've gone to so many Mariner games, and you know, it's a place that is also near and dear to my heart, hoping to get back there sometime next year. But you know, as far as you know, just thinking, you know, it just felt like a, you know, a natural thing to, you know, what, you know, try to come up with a background story for Eddie, you know.
Right.
You know, I mean, somebody who, you know, and a lot of people who become major league or even minor league ball players, they end up in a different part of the country from where they came from. So it just seemed like, you know, just seemed natural that, you know, you're born and raised in Seattle, and so say you get drafted by the Brewers or Montreal, and, you know, maybe you get traded to Double A Binghamton somewhere along the way, and one thing leads to another, and you end up in Long Island.
Well, Brian, you write, like I've said, a lot about the Mets, put a lot in there. As a matter of fact, time frame, there is a part there where DeGrom goes to Texas. I'm not giving anything away with the book, but DeGrom goes to Texas, and they bring in Verlander. And in the book, they're disgusted with DeGrom, but they're excited about Verlander. And what's so funny is that was the mood at the time, but now we know what happened. So,
yeah,
I bet you wish you could go back.
Hindsight
and edit.
Is always 2020, but yeah, it's, you know, at the time, you know, it, you know, you're, you know, I wanted to make the, you know, the characters are Met fans, and they have to echo the sentiment of the Met fans.
It's, right.
You know, I mean, yeah, DeGrom, as great as he was, you know, there was no guarantee that he was going to be healthy, and just what was what it was.
So, Brian, as a Met fan, what is your earliest, I want to say, good memory of the Mets, you know, because most people's earliest recollections is going to be a losing season. But so what's your earliest recollections of the Mets?
Well, my first Met game that I ever attended was in July of 83. It was a birthday present for my mother. My grandfather took my mother and I to Shea, and it happened to be a night that Nolan Ryan was pitching for Houston. It was the Mets were home against the Astros, and my mother was a huge Nolan Ryan fan growing up. She was disgusted when he left. You know, the whole Ryan for Fregosi rigmarole. You know, but yeah, so. So that was my first Met game, and we got field level seats about halfway up the third base side. And I'd started playing Little League at the time, so I brought my glove with me. And, you know, but my mother was steadfast. She's like, if a ball comes over here, you have to duck. And I didn't know what she was talking about. Like, you know, my 7-year-old brain is like, okay, if somebody throws me a ball, I catch it. Well, sure enough, around the 7th inning, and Mookie Wilson hits one right over towards us. And, you know, I jump up, and then all of a sudden I realize this ball is coming faster than I've ever seen. And I duck at the last minute. My grandfather reaches over and snatches it with two bare hands.
Wow.
Absolutely true story.
All right.
That's a great story.
You still have the ball?
No, unfortunately, I don't. Believe it or not, you know, I got the ball, and I probably stuck it in a pile with all my other baseballs that I played with, and not realizing the significance of it. So,
yeah.
But there is another ball I have. Years later, I went to the vet in Philadelphia, and Frank Viola threw me a ball over the outfield fence.
Nice.
So I still have that one.
Yeah. Brian, take us through the process a little bit, especially as a writer of fiction. You know, you can go in any direction you want, but it still has to be with this book, because it's not science. It's not, you know, it's not science fiction. So it's got to have a progression and stuff. But take us through how you come up with a story like this without giving it away. I hope you could do that.
Well, I actually started writing the backstory for the character Eddie Fitzgerald a few years back. I just couldn't think of a good story for him. You know, I had written my first book, which is called Being Made, many years ago, and then I started trying to write a follow-up, and I just thought of this character and thought of the whole background, you know, like born and raised in Seattle, and then he does whatever, and I just couldn't think of a story for him. And it was one of those things where, in a way, art was imitating life, because in the book, we go through the pandemic. During that time, I had befriended some people on social media who were sports fans, you know, not baseball fans, but, you know, fans of other sports. And eventually got to meeting them in person. And one day, I just kind of woke up and I just realized that this would be a good template for something that would happen with Eddie. You know, he lives his life, and then the pandemic kind of throws everything into a tizzy. And then he has to kind of pick up the pieces and move from there. And then from that point, it was just, what kind of story do I want to come up with? You know, how does he play off of all the other characters? You know, what happens? You know, like there's sort of a love story in there, and how does that play out? And, you know, I'm very much a plotter, so I tried to outline as much as possible. I come up with ideas and I think of it and just try to interweave everything in a way that it makes sense. And that works to a certain extent, but, you know, and even then it's like, well, halfway through, I realized that a couple of the supporting characters had nothing to do, and I had to kind of come up with something on the fly. So,
yeah, it was, if you like the TV show Friends, you might like this too, because there's a good group of friends and it's nice. They have the relationship is nice, but, and then you have all these offshoots. It's just, I'm always amazed by a writer's mind, how you come up with this, but I guess, you know, you just got a great imagination too.
You know, it's just, I felt inspired and it just kind of came to me.
Okay.
If you indulge me, because, like Glenn said, we don't want to give anything of the plot away, but I'm going to read a review on Amazon. It says, this is an excellent read for sports fans, romantics, and anyone who appreciates a good story of friendship, growth, and unity. Scala's writing style is smooth and engaging. His story is relatable and a definite page turner. I'd absolutely give this one 5 stars. So that is some review, and it goes on. I mean, there's plenty of them you can read on Amazon, but that just tells you something that how good this book is.
Well, that's very kind words.
Yeah, that really is. Yeah. So I recommend the book. There's a lot that goes on in it. It's fun to of course see places that I know, but it's a fun read. It's nice because it's just, that's what it is. It's a fun read. It's nothing too serious. Although there are a couple of serious, no, I shouldn't say that, because there are a couple of things in there. Yeah.
Triggers, so to speak.
Yeah, no, there is.
Especially towards the end.
So Yeah. So it's, but it is, it's really good. I guess you like baseball and you like hockey, and they're both in this book.
Yes. Well, you know, to an extent there's hockey. I mean, there's a couple of hockey references, but it's,
yeah, that's what it is.
Yes.
It's mostly baseball. It's mostly right. baseball. That's why I thought Jeff would love this book.
Yes. I again, yeah, exactly. You know, the reference to the Mets, Long Island. So I definitely love the book. I'm wondering if there's a sequel to, is this going to be a series for Eddie?
I'm not planning on it. I mean, it's, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility. I know a lot of authors tend to do books in a series these days. You know, it's not something that I had envisioned, but it's, you know, never say never. There's certainly, you know, a room for a sequel if, you know, to find out what happens with some of the other characters down the line and even with Eddie.
You don't write as your full-time job, but is that the goal? Would you like to be are authors actually, do they do that full-time? I don't even know.
Most of them, I would say, do not, especially in indie authors. You know, it's not as, you know, it's it sounds glamorous, but it's really not as lucrative as most people would think. You know, there's a lot that goes into, without getting into too much specifics, it's, you know, the cost of publishing and marketing and promoting and you know, going to all these author signing events. It's
it costs money.
A lot of, you know, and a lot of the independent authors that I know are not able to make a living doing this full time.
Yeah, sounds like podcasting.
I was gonna say, if you have a podcast and a book, may have it made.
You know, as of right now, it's a labor of love for me. And I mean, you know, the dream would be to be able to do this full time, but it's at this moment, it's not feasible.
Okay, so then I got one for you. It might not be feasible until you sell one of these books and they make a movie. So if Eddie the Legend is a movie, who plays Eddie?
Wow, that's a good question. And by the way, that is like my ultimate dream. Like, you know, the pie in the sky is to one day have a film adaptation of one of my books. Let me see. So who would play Eddie the Legend? Let's see. You think of somebody, you know, who could play somebody who's somewhat athletic or looks athletic, somebody maybe in their early to mid 40s. Maybe
Adam
somebody,
Driver.
Adam Driver. Or, you know, I'm thinking somebody like Bradley Cooper.
There you go. Okay. He's getting a little older, though. A little older.
Yeah.
But okay. Yeah. Bradley Cooper. Yeah. Okay. And then there's another character in the book. Am I allowed to say? I'm not ruining it if I say the other character. Danny. D-A-N-I. And who's playing her?
Well, she would be harder to cast, I think, you know, because they're... You know, it's hard to come up with, like I said, not to give away too much, but it's most Hollywood actresses are, you know, she's a full figured person. And it's hard to think of somebody who would, you know, you would cast, you know, that would be somebody I think you would want to cast an unknown, just have somebody.
Okay.
Like a breakout role. You know, I think
Brian, you'd be at the casting call. You'd be like, you're sitting there and
if I had to think about it, you know, that would be the type of character you would want to find somebody like nobody heard of Renee Zellweger until she did Jerry Maguire. You know, this would be somebody that you would think of in like a breakout role.
All right. Well, listen, I hope everyone goes out and gets Eddie the Legend. We're going to ask you to tell us how they may do that. But then I hope I one day see this on the big screen, the little screen. Well, there are no little screens anymore, but on a screen. I hope I see this. Eddie the Legend by Brian Scala.
Thank you. Yeah. And you know, it's possible. You know, they do have movies come out on streaming services now. So
How can our audience get Eddie the Legend?
Well, it is available on my website, brianscala.com. You can get it on Amazon. It's also available on Barnes & Noble. And if you are local to Long Island, it is also, there's a few copies at the Next Chapter bookstore in Huntington.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Excellent.
The former book review.
Yes.
Before we let you go, Brian, I want to know about your vintage Epcot memorabilia.
Oh boy. Let me see. What do we have here? It's, I am, you know, that was another thing that I loved growing up was, you know, I've been to Epcot numerous times. I don't know exactly what I would, what I have that would be, you know, valuable, so to speak. But recently, my mother gave me something for my birthday. It is a limited print. There was an artist rendition of the old Dreamfinder machine from the Journey into Imagination Pavilion. And I have that framed right. Actually, I'm looking at it right now. It's at my desk.
Nice.
I mean, I collected a couple of like a Epcot opening day, like a replica opening day ticket, some old maps like from the 80s and 90s. I have a couple of old magnets of all of the I have a set of the magnets of all of the old logos from all the original Epcot pavilions, like you know, Horizons, World of Motion, the Living Seas.
Nice. Well, well, sounds great, Brian. We appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. Like
thank you, Brian.
Len said, go out and get the book, Barnes & Noble, your website, BrianScala.com, and you know, hope you do well. Thanks.
Thank you very much for having me.
Eddie the Legend.
And thank you, Brian, for joining us on Baseball and BBQ. I liked that book. I really did.
Yeah, it was a great book.
Eddie's a legend.
Yes, he is. You got to read the book to find out why he's a legend. But yes. And you know, Jeff, Brian was our third guest. But if it was a lineup of three, isn't your best hitter your third hitter?
Yeah, I guess so.
Usually, right? So, Brian, you certainly we thank you very much. You gave us a lot of fun with Eddie the Legend. So, Jeff, now comes the point where we've got to thank people, all right? So who are we going to thank first?
I'm going to thank my mom and my dad for this very strategic. Oh, I'm only kidding. thank you, Leonard, for joining me on Baseball and BBQ.
Well, I appreciate that. I was going to say Todd Zeal, but...
Oh, okay, Todd Zeal too.
were you practicing your award acceptance speech?
Exactly, yes.
Very good. So we've got to thank Todd Zeal, Monica Bedlani, Brian Scala, the listeners, you, your mom and dad, and let's just say we're going to end with the poet, Shel Krakowski, and the musician, Dave Dresser. And let's remind everyone before we bring the song on, we are presented by Bet Online. It is where the game starts. And as we are telling you, we're ending a big show with baseball always brings you home.
See you next time on episode 225.